All right, y'all. It's the show. Happy Monday to you. I don't know. Happy Monday? Is that a thing you say to people? It's the radio show. Just like the past few Mondays, except skip one in there. Mike Swanson's going to be back on the show. I think we're going to conclude our series of interviews here about the war state. For now, anyway. He's already working on his Vietnam book. But Michael Swanson, he's written this great history of, the first three presidential administrations. Well, I guess not. The first three presidents and their administrations after World War II. So, Truman, Ike, Kennedy. The rise of the military-industrial complex and the power elite. And the end of the old constitutional order. Such as it was. The war state. Michael Swanson back on the show here in just a little while. And in an even littler while, Lawrence Wilkerson will be back on the show. Former lieutenant something. What was he? He was Colonel Wilkerson. Was he a lieutenant colonel or a colonel colonel? I think he was a colonel. Anyway, he was the aide to Secretary of State Colin Powell. And helped lie us into war with Iraq. And has been saying sorry and telling the truth about foreign policy ever since then. So, Larry Wilkerson, he'll be on the show. He's actually got his own thing called the Wilkerson Report now. A segment on the real news. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting Jay's last name there. The guy that does the real news. It's a good show. But anyway, so Lawrence Wilkerson, he's got his own show on there. And he's a professor at William & Mary now. And yeah, anyway, so let me talk with him about current events. Iran, Syria, Israel, Palestine. That kind of thing. So that should be good, right? All right, good. So, we have so much to cover on the show today. It's hard for me to choose, but this should be first because I think it's important and also I can dispense with it pretty quickly. There's a new book out by some political reporter types, and they claim to have multiple sources quoting the President of the United States after he had been meditating. Now, this is the telephone game a little bit. This is the Washington Post review of this new book. Says that Obama had been meditating about his drone strikes and told his aides, got up and told his aides, I'm really good at killing people. Now, as a crybaby liberal in my Twitter feed last night was complaining, we don't really know exactly what he meant. We don't really know exactly what the sources are, who the multiple sources are for this. Supposedly there are multiple sources for it. He must have been being sarcastic, or it must just be a misquote, because dear leader would never say something so horrible, you know. He might kill people all day, every day. He might excel at murder. He would never say something so crass. He'll kill a little kid. He will tear a little kid limb from limb. But he would never say, I tear little kids limb from limb, because that just would not be acceptable. It's just impossible. It must be a conservative right-wing lie that he would ever say that. Well, anyway, I could see him saying it as, in his own words, to paraphrase Obama in another context about the economy, gallows humor. Maybe he was talking about what a complete and utter and total failure he is at everything good he ever said he was going to do. Sure hadn't done a damn thing to liberate Palestine or even make a deal with Iran or lie the country into war with Syria. Sure am good at killing Somalis, though, I guess. You know, maybe he meant it like that. But anyway, the fact of the matter is, yeah, he's a killer. And you know, Jeremy Scahill was on the show this morning on MSNBC, or this afternoon, earlier this afternoon. And they were saying, well, you know, compared to George Bush and the wanton slaughter in Iraq, the absolute disaster that came from that full-scale ground invasion with more than 100,000 men and the civil war that followed and everything, I guess comparatively speaking, the drone war is a smarter, more scalpel-y way to do it rather than the bludgeon. And Scahill says, yeah, but Obama, I mean, if you accept that, he didn't just say, yeah, of course, or anything, but if you accept that, still, Obama doubled down in Afghanistan. Doesn't anybody remember that? The surge in Afghanistan that everybody already knew could not possibly work? That was simply for domestic politics. Well, come on, he was ending the Iraq war. Well, he was getting kicked out of the country by the Shiites, and he wasn't going to fight about it. Could he end two wars, or might the Republicans call him a sissy? And if they called him a sissy, might that cost a couple of House seats in the midterm elections in 2010? And could it even cost him re-election in 2012? So, what's the lives of a few tens of thousands of Afghans and a few thousand, a couple thousand Americans compared to his political ambitions? Nothing. So he escalated the war. And the Washington Post, Pravda of Washington, D.C., they wrote a thing, excerpt from a book called Little America, which is a book written by one of their reporters, made it past the Washington Post editors and everything, that Obama refused to read a CIA report that he already knew said, don't do it. They said, hey, here's that CIA report that says, don't do it. It's not going to work. It can't, quote unquote, work. There's nothing to work. The surge in Afghanistan can't accomplish the stated objectives for Afghanistan. Obama knew it said that, didn't read it. So he'd have plausible deniability that, no, nobody ever told me that's what it said, that report I refused to read, I guess. That's something we're going to talk about a little bit later on the show, too. It would be how the generals kind of forced him into it, but he's still the president. He could have just said, Patrice, you're fired. McChrystal, you're fired. You're not going to put a bunch of leaks in the newspaper trying to end run me and force me into escalating a war for your benefit. You're both fired. How do you like that? That's what a real man would have done. That's what a real woman would have done. That's what a little boy would have done. But not Barack Obama. He rolled right over, escalated the war. And then, of course, he's been murdering Yemenis, Somalis, Libyans, Syrians, Iranians this whole time. You know, when George W. Bush took power, he bombed Iraq within a week. It was a week and 3 days, something like that. No, it was 1 week, I think. Sworn in on the 20th, and then it was like the 27th, maybe 28th of January. George W. Bush bombed Iraq. Barack Obama, after he became president in 2009, 3 days. He bombed Pakistan 3 days after becoming president. Killed a bunch of innocent civilians, too. So, who knows whether he really said it or not. The only thing that matters is, it's true. Barack Obama is a mass murderer. He kills people all day. And of course, conservatives love nothing more than mass murder all day. They love mass murder all day a lot more than they love Jesus, a lot more than they love their own sons. Watch them send their sons to go die killing people for American politicians. Conservatives worship violence above all, so they don't mind. And liberals worship Democrats above all, so they don't mind either. So you have a few hardcore principled anti-war people on the left, mostly on the far left. The worse you are on economics, the better you are on empire. I'm not sure why. And the libertarians. And Scahill pointed that out on the show, too. Said liberals are so invested in this president, they're willing to look the other way as he kills kids. How true it is. Anyway, the book is Doubled Down. The journalists are Mark Halperin and John Heilman. One of them was on MSNBC this morning. I don't know why I was watching MSNBC this morning. The masochist in me. I don't think they asked him about this, though. But that's the quote. According to at least two aides of Barack Obama, he said with his own words, "I'm really good at killing people." Doesn't that sound like exactly what George Bush would have said? Well, of course, once Obama kills them, then retroactively they're guilty, as Scahill also pointed out on the show today. Whoever they kill is a combatant, or else they wouldn't be dead. That's the rules. America. I bet everybody else in the world, they're just buying that, huh? Oh, when you guys murder innocents, it's virtuous because it's you guys doing it, huh? Yeah, oh, we buy that. That makes perfect sense. Oh, because you like to believe it, we're supposed to believe it too. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. That's what all 6.5 billion other people in the world think. Yeah, go ahead and murder us. Hey, go ahead and lie about why you're murdering us. It's fine. You're really good at killing people. Who are we to deny you the opportunity to do the only thing you're really good at all? Yeah, I read that in the Washington Post, too. All right, let's see. The rest of that section is saving for the interview. Now to Edward Snowden, a manifesto for the truth. This was published at Der Spiegel on Sunday, and you can read the whole thing at antiwar.com. It's the spotlight essay today. In a very short time, the world has learned much about the unaccountable secret agencies and about sometimes illegal surveillance programs. Sometimes the agencies even deliberately try to hide their surveillance of high officials or the public. While the NSA and the GCHQ seem to be the worst offenders, this is what the currently available documents suggest. We must not forget that mass surveillance is a global problem in need of global solutions. I don't know about that. Such programs are not only a threat to privacy, they also threaten freedom of speech and open societies. The existence of spy technology should not determine policy. We have a moral duty to ensure that our laws and values limit monitoring programs and the protection of human rights. Society can only understand and control these problems through an open, respectful, and informed debate. At first, some governments, feeling embarrassed by the revelations of mass surveillance, initiated an unprecedented campaign of persecution to suppress this debate. They intimidated journalists and criminalized publishing the truth. At this point, the public was not yet able to evaluate the benefits of the revelations. They relied on their governments to decide correctly. Today, we know that this was a mistake and that such action does not serve the public interest. The debate which they wanted to prevent will now take place in countries around the world. Instead of doing harm, the societal benefits of this new public knowledge is now clear, since reforms are now proposed in the form of increased oversight and new legislation. Citizens have to fight suppression of information on matters of vital public importance. To tell the truth is not a crime. And, yeah, boy, got that right. So that's Edward Snowden, a short and sweet manifesto there, published in Der Spiegel. You can find it at antiwar.com today. It's the spotlight. And, you know, it reminds me, and I brought this up from time to time, too. And, you know me, I'm more of a current events guy than, you know, very smart or anything. But I once read a book by Neil Postman called Technopoly, The Surrender of Culture to Technology. And the bottom line was that every part of our lives and our society and even the way that we look at the world is determined by the technology that we use. And that we live in America now in a society where anything, any gadget that can be invented and will be implemented as soon as it's cheap enough to do it. And that there's that it is a total surrender of culture. And in a way, I think the author's kind of a conservative in a sense where he's trying to conserve classical liberalism in a way, you know what I mean? Sort of a paleocon, kind of a stodgy old Jeffersonian in that sense, you know? And he's saying that, you know, look, we let opinion be defined by a 1-0 opinion poll where the question is rigged. And the choice of answers are only two, and neither of them satisfactory. And yet we let that dictate, you know, all kinds of things. Not just policy, but even what everybody else understands about what everybody else thinks about things. And it's just, as the wife likes to say, we're looking at the map of a country that's no longer there, you know? We're living on the face of one that no longer exists. And so, the thing of it is, what Edward Snowden is doing is he's, in a sense, you could even call him just a determined kind of a thing. He's not even an agent of his own free will here. He's the natural result of this process of the, the integration of all circuits in one big network, you know? At some point, there are people who have enough kind of old reactionary sort of tie to the culture that they used to think that they signed up to protect in the first place, that, you know, they have that conflict. What do they do with their cognitive dissonance? Swallow their pride and you know, keep paying that mortgage? Or go ahead and do something crazy and liberate the documents and hand them over to Glenn Greenwald so that the people can hear the truth? And then, when they do make a decision, people like Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden and others who have decided to liberate these truths and bring them to us, they give us very narrow windows of opportunity where people are outraged enough to insist that this stuff gets rolled back. Let it not go down in history that every time we had an opportunity for debate, as he talks about here, that we shrugged it off. And of course, the TV headlines and the newspaper headlines keep repeating that, oh, Americans don't care about this, but that's not what the polls say. That's just what the headlines say, because they're trying to convince you nobody else cares but you, so it's too much of an uphill battle, you can't win it, so don't even bother. When the truth of the matter is that actually we are in a position, the regular masses of powerless Americans, when we combine together, we do have the power to stop things like this, and pretty much all of us regular powerful powerless people, the 275 million of us or whatever it is, are pretty much all good on this. And pretty much are defaulting toward, hey, let's kind of slow it down here a little bit about just how much power we give to the state. Hell, I saw Patrick Leahy on TV this morning saying, hey, man, you know, the government could say, well, we have to come into your office at your home and dig through all of your papers and scan them all and upload them all into our databases just in case we ever need them. Would that be tolerable? No. We could put a camera, he didn't say this exact words, but close enough. We could put a camera in every house to prevent domestic violence. Microphones, too. That's some of the worst violence in America, right? Is guys beating their spouses. So, and vice versa. But, oh well. We're not going to go that far because then we would be more threatened by our totalitarian state of so-called protectors than from the danger. Anyway, so thanks, Ed Snowden, and do your part to pick up where he left off, y'all, is what I mean. While you have a chance. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. You can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And hey, by the way, go stop by the chat room. It's just ScottHorton.org/chat. I just signed in. Hey, guys. A few people in there. ScottHorton.org/chat if you want to hang out during the live show. By the way, if you're hearing this later on in the future sometime, it's 3 to 5 Eastern, live here on Liberty Express, No Agenda Radio, ScottHorton.org, Anomaly Radio, and other stuff like that. Right now, it's November the 4th, 2013. Okay, so that's the Snowden Manifesto. You can find that at antiwar.com today. And then there's all this other NSA news. White House rejects clemency for Snowden because they're jerks. And then this is the latest big story is from Julian Borger. GCHQ and European spy agencies work together on mass surveillance. Edward Snowden papers unmask close technical cooperation and loose alliance between British, German, French, Spanish, and Swedish spy agencies. Dang! Yeah, they're all in and against you, Mr. Deck. Including me. But then, here's what's really important, too. The New York Times has this thing by Scott Shane, which, you know, Assange criticized this, WikiLeaks criticized this as sort of a modified limited hangout where they tell you a whole bunch of stories at once in kind of a limited form. Yeah, kind of, but then again, it's useful in its own way where, man, look at all the stuff that they're doing. It's no morsel too minuscule for the all-consuming NSA. No morsel too minuscule for the all-consuming NSA. That gets into a whole lot of what they're up to. Global phone book. Mapping message trails. Pressure to get everything. And then The Guardian has this thingamajig too. What NSA files decoded. Edward Snowden's surveillance revelations explained. NSA files decoded. What the revelations mean for you. That's at The Guardian. And by the way, I don't have it in front of me here, but Al Jazeera, America.aljazeera.com, they actually have a really good timeline of all of the different Snowden revelations and what they all mean, you know, breaking down. And the thing that what's nice about having an Al Jazeera is because since none of this stuff has been written for them, they're just cataloging everything that's been written everywhere. So here's all the stuff from The Times, The Post, The Guardian, El Globo in Brazil, and what you call it in India, and Die Zeit, and Der Spiegel, and La Figaro, and all of the different articles and all the different publications, ProPublica, where they publish Snowden revelations. This Al Jazeera timeline has it all there for you. It's one of those things you can just pin this tab and just save that thing, go through and study it at your leisure. There's a lot to understand here, and I admit, I need to do a better job. You know, it's sort of like when I was first learning about Iran's nuclear program and all the non-proliferation treaties and stuff. I just read like 50 Gordon Prather articles. And then I was like, oh, okay, I think I get it now. And that's just what I need to do with this. It's hard for me to get my head around all the different stuff. All the legalities, the 207, the 215, and the 12333. And then all of the different, you know, data in motion versus data at rest and hacking into clouds and spying on sovereign leaders. It's a lot. But anyways, I promise to do better about that. Here's one that's interesting. NSA tracked Israeli military targets. More interesting than that to me was the question of whether they are tapping Benjamin Netanyahu's phone. And then Marcy Wheeler, of course, we talked with her last week, and this got a slight mention, but it was kind of in the middle of another context. I don't think we got to elaborate, but she had a thing on her blog saying, I wonder if this is why John McCain all of a sudden cares about the NSA spying. Oh my God, you're tapping Benjamin Netanyahu's phone? Well, then what might you have recorded me saying to him? Panic sets in. I think that would be great. I hope that that's what Glenn Greenwald is saving up. All the different transcripts of American politicians swearing their fealty to a foreign state. Give me them transcripts, Glenn. I'm just speculating. I don't know. I sure hope that's what it is. Oh, by the way, this ain't playing around either. David Cameron is threatening the media over the NSA and GCHQ. They don't have the First Amendment there. We talked about this last week, I think, about at least my perspective is that without the First Amendment, which is the only one we got left pretty much of the Bill of Rights, at least that you can really count on as far as freedom of the press, freedom to choose your own church, and that kind of thing, or to not go. It's the only reason that the press is able to get away with even what they get away with now, what they try to get away with. The things that we say on our Facebook pages and whatever, us regular folk. It's that First Amendment. It's all we got left. Over there in England, it's the mirror image of us, but without that written constitution, without that iron law that says freedom of the press. And, you know, we could lose it very quickly. In fact, Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com had an article about that, how, you know, there's a propaganda campaign on to just normalize the idea that, yeah, one day they're going to prosecute that Greenwald under the very loosest interpretation of the Espionage Act of 1917. Thanks a lot, Woodrow Wilson. Yeah, publishers, journalists could be counted in there, too. They just never have been. There was one case in the Civil War where they were outright printing broken codes, something like that, for the enemy in the middle of the war, and it was something. But even then, I think the courts have overruled the decisions there since. But anyway, Raimondo's right that they're trying to create an atmosphere where, yep, that's where we are now. It used to be we didn't torture people, but now we do. It used to be that you could punish the leaker, but you couldn't publish the reporter. But yeah, now you can. You see how easy it is for them to do that to us. We just, huh? Well, it used to be that if you get found not guilty, they have to let you go. But no, we got a new thing now that's called, screw that. Go ahead and keep you, even after you've been acquitted. And they're moving that way. All right, man, I had a lot more I didn't get a chance to talk about on the show. I got to figure out how to talk faster. Coming up, Larry Wilkerson, right after this.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com.
or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. My website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. Whole show archives, too. But more than 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. And, of course, we're live here 3 to 5 Eastern Time at LibertyExpressRadio.com, NoAgendaStream.com, AnomalyRadio.com, and, well, a few other places, too. Our first guest on the show today is formerly an aide to Secretary of State Colin Powell and a colonel in, I think, the U.S. Army. And now he is a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at William and Mary. And he also has hosts the Wilkerson Report, or I guess is interviewed on what's called the Wilkerson Report, a regular spot on The Real News at therealnews.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Larry?
I'm doing fine. I hope you are, too.
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. And what I want to talk with you about mostly, or at least here first to start, is the talks with Iran. And just what you think of them. We've gone through one round now, and we got the second round is due to start, I believe, this Thursday in Geneva. And I would just add one little factoid here before I turn it over to you, and that would be the warning given by the Supreme Ayatollah Khamenei, I guess yesterday, warning the hardline rightists in Iran that they better not undermine the nuclear talks. What do you make of that?
I think it's just another indicator that the Iranians are truly serious. They've been serious before. Unfortunately, we spurned them when they were. The most recent time was in my period in the administration in the spring of 2003. But they're deadly serious this time, if I may use that phrase, and I hope we are too. I sometimes long for the kind of draconian measures that might be available to one like George W. Bush, for example, to suppress our own hardliners. I mean, that's not putting too fine a point on it, but there are some people in both political parties, Bob Menendez, for example, in the Democratic Party, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, very important position, and John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and others in my party, who simply don't want to give the president the kind of maneuver room he needs in order to effect a diplomatic solution to this challenge. And frankly, I think that's extremely sad, and I hope and pray that it doesn't derail what promises to be the first chance at real substantive negotiations in a long, long time.
Well, I'm happy to hear I'm not the only one who wants to waterboard Lindsey Graham.
I won't crawl over to the opposition and become as low as them. I refuse to do that. I think John McCain was right when he made one of his most brilliant statements when he was referring to his opposition to torture in all guises. He said, it's not about them, it's about us.
Yeah, well, we wouldn't want to become like Lindsey Graham and John McCain. And in fact, you know, John McCain, he claims fame for being anti-torture, but he's really not. He's the guy that took all of the teeth out of the anti-torture legislation in 2005 and 6.
Well, there's some truth to that. I have to say that since I was intimately involved in, along with 35 other general officers, former secretaries of the Navy and so forth, in an attempt to help him to get the armed forces out of the torture business, that I think more or less we achieved our objective. What you're referring to, I believe, is more his escape clause, if you will, for the CIA, arguably the most egregious, at the end of the day, the most egregious abusers of both the international convention and U.S. domestic law.
They did the rewrite of Appendix M to go ahead and legalize all kinds of sleep deprivation and temperature manipulation and things that had been the subject of the ban in the first place.
You mean to the Army Field Manual?
Yeah, that was the sleight of hand, even more than taking the CIA thing out, I thought, was saying, the Army can only treat people the way it's described in the Field Manual. Let's rewrite the Field Manual.
Well, if you look at it very, very closely, I think you'll find that you don't have the kind of compilation, the kind of composite that you had with Rumsfeld's December memo, for example. You don't
have
what Alberto Mora called, put these all together and do them over time, you got torture. And I hope the armed forces have learned a lesson from this. From my talks with some of the leadership they have, this is not something the armed forces have any business being involved in, period.
Yeah. Well, you know, JSOC, according to Jeremy Scahill at The Nation, they help run, with the CIA, they help run a torture prison beneath a dungeon, I guess, beneath Mogadishu, where people are regularly mistreated. So I don't know if that's just completely covert and therefore outside the law entirely, or if there's a guideline they're pretending to follow there. What do you think of that?
Well, this is one of the most dangerous developments that has come out of this so-called never-ending war on terror, and that is the way the CIA and, to a certain extent, JSOC is the command headquarters, but certainly one or two of the SEAL teams and the Delta Force have become more or less symbiotic in their relationship. And what this does is it puts the military at the cutting edge of what are, according to the 1947 Act and amendments thereto, legal only performed by the CIA, covert operations is the common jargon. It puts them at the leading edge of doing direct action and covert actions. This is a bad development. It's a dangerous development because, one, it gets those actions out from under the oversight of the two committees, the HPSI and the CISI, in the House and the Senate, the oversight committees for intelligence. And two, and more serious, it puts the military into these egregious actions that we all know from the history of the CIA is constantly involved in. Now, we can argue all day long about whether or not a power like the United States that pretends to be a democracy and pretends to answer to the people can have something like the covert side of the CIA and still pretend. But even if you believe it should, it ought to have some oversight and it ought to have some rules it goes by. And it shouldn't operate in total secrecy all the time. That's what they've got now with the military being the cutting edge of the CIA's covert operations. This is a dangerous marriage.
Well, and of course, the scrutiny level is so much different than during the Bush years. We've got Jeremy Scahill and then Eli Lake, interestingly enough, reported on another torture prison. I think this one was up in Puntland or in Somaliland. I think up in Puntland. A separate, different. He wasn't confirming Scahill's story. He had a separate story, but along the same lines. Americans helping run this prison where people are being mistreated. But then that's it, right? After that, crickets.
Well, let's look at the whole ballgame here. And let me back up for a moment and say, I think these revelations that are coming out and these investigative reporters are going to keep digging. The revelations are going to keep coming. The more draconian the American government becomes, the more whistleblowers we're going to have. And that's healthy and that's good. And it may be the only thing that in the end saves us. But let me say that one of the things that's happening now, I think, is that with this kind of whistleblower revelation, you're getting government acting in a more transparent and a more sane and sober way. It's slow and it's difficult. But once you get this light shining on all these activities, especially those that are completely in secret, I think you're going to have a government that has to be more forthcoming about what it's doing. If it isn't, if it becomes more draconian, more secretive, and more clandestine, then I shudder for our republic. I mean, we're moving swiftly towards what James Madison would have clearly identified as a constant state of war and creeping tyranny.
Yeah. All right, now, so along those lines, but back to the Iran talks, how do you call the score on this? I mean, do you think that Barack Obama, like on a 1 to 10 scale, how serious is he about seeing this thing through? And then I guess sort of secondarily to that, is there a factional fight within the American establishment? Does anybody within the military, within the think tanks, within some business interests, oil versus banking, something, anybody, the arms manufacturers, is anybody deciding that, you know what, we would rather go ahead and start warming up relations with the Iranians now, we're tired of the Cold War, or is it just this one issue that maybe they want to get past the nuclear issue, but they, you know what I mean? Is there a change going on here?
part of the problem, if not a large part of the problem, is that no one wants to be truthful about what's really going on. What's really going on is not so much the nuclear issue. That's just the subsurface or surface strata. What's really going on underneath, subterraneously, is a power struggle in the Gulf. And the power struggle is three-pronged, in essence. It has on the one prong Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council, and they want to be the hegemon. It has on the other prong Israel, which is worried about anybody having any kind of hegemony in that region without Israel's blessing. The second or third prong, if you will, is Iran, and they're the natural hegemon in the region by demography, by military characteristics, by national characteristics, by economic and financial, you name it. Iran, for 26 years, we recognized Iran as the hegemon and let them guard the Gulf for us. Those 26 years, of course, featured the Shah as our tyrant. So this battle is going on. Who's going to be boss in the Gulf? And the Israelis see a rapprochement between Tehran and Washington as being bad for their interest in that respect, as do the Saudis and the GCC. So this is a situation that is all about power and power struggles regionally and ultimately globally, rather than about who's going to have a nuke or not. Frankly, I believe that the Iranians have the attitude that if you won't invade me and you'll promise not to invade me, I'll never build a nuclear weapon. The only reason I want to build a nuclear weapon, if in fact I do, is because you might invade me. And cast your eyes over at North Korea and see why they built nuclear weapons, essentially for the same purpose. So if you look at it from the perspective of this power struggle and you try to examine the challenge contained in dealing with that power struggle, it becomes an even more formidable problem in terms of diplomacy. Why are the Saudis announcing things like they won't take their seat on the UN Security Council? Why are they giving every signal that they are backing away from their close relationship with the United States, which, frankly, I could care less about? It's about time we backed away a little. Why are they doing this, though? Because they are looking at us with respect to Syria, where we didn't drop bombs, with respect to Iran, where we're negotiating. They're looking at us as leaving the power relationship with them and replacing it with a rapprochement with Iran, with a closer relationship with people in the region whom they don't like. They're even in a tacit alliance with Israel right now to oppose Bashar al-Assad in Syria and ultimately Iran. So you look at all the little pieces of this struggle in the region and of this geostrategic lockup or lash-up in the region, and it becomes an incredibly difficult thing for President Obama to achieve what he needs to achieve, which is a win-win situation. And by that I mean, at the end of the negotiations, the Iranians have a little bit of what they want, relief from sanctions principally, and we have a little bit of what we want, which is, of course, a verifiable nuclear program under the very watchful eye of the IAEA and very, very rigorous inspections for however long we need them. That's a very winnable situation diplomatically. But when you start talking about all the other things I've just thrown in there, Assad in Syria, the king and the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, Egypt falling apart on Israel's flank, Israel looking more and more as if it's going to be an apartheid state instead of somehow accommodating a two-state solution. You throw all these other features into it, and it becomes an extremely diplomatic road to walk down successfully.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so my thing about it, and obviously I'm no State Department guy or whatever, I look at it from sort of an oversimplified point of view, but it seems to me like if the State Department guys wanted to do a redirection, or at least split the difference, you know, they fought the whole Iraq war for Iran, basically, and then they did the redirection back towards Saudi Arabia, like they're following through now with the war back in the rebels, so-called rebels in Syria and all of that. But if the Likud party, if Netanyahu and the Israeli government's obsession is Hezbollah, I mean, if you go back to the clean break and all of this, it's we got to get the Americans to take out Saddam for us because that'll weaken Iran and Syria, which will weaken Hezbollah, right? That's their whole thing all along, right? But
let me just say where I don't disagree with you, but I take it even further. Netanyahu's government, backed extensively by the Russian emigres into Israel,
mm-hmm.
people like Avigdor Lieberman. Their policy is, yes, to get rid of Hezbollah, but you have to look at the strategic objective that that is a policy ingredient of. And the strategic objective is a greater Israel. It's very clear that that's Netanyahu's strategic objective. What do I mean by that?
Well, but wait a minute. Let me get back to that in a second, because I actually want to hear your whole thing about that. And I heard what you said on The Real News the other day, and I had that in my notes to ask you about. But just as far as their problem with the so-called Shiite arc, it seems like, even if Netanyahu can't see it, the Democrats have a great argument that, listen, if we can befriend Iran, then that kind of undoes the oops for empowering them with the Iraq war. It takes their power out from behind Assad, who needs it to help them, and same for Nasrallah. So you can build your greater Israel even better if we make friends with Iran rather than continuing this Cold War, which just pushes every Shiite faction in the entire region into their camp, right? That, so I'm trying to think like a good imperialist here.
No, you just outlined what used to be Israeli policy. I mean, that used to be Israeli policy, and it was augmented and aided and abetted by the fact that the Persians are Persians and not Arabs. So there was a natural affinity between the Jews and the Persians, both being not Arab and being opposed to most Arabs. So you're right, but that dynamic has changed, and has changed majorly with two essential factors. One is the isolation of Iran, and the other is the rise to power of what I will call non-1948 Jews in Israel. And by that I mean the massive Russian immigration and the fixation on that immigration by the Netanyahu types in Israel, who have latched onto those immigrés and onto the more right-wing parties in Israel for their political power. They couldn't turn loose if they wanted to. And it's been very politically opportunistic, but it's also been very politically successful. Look at Netanyahu. He's been in power for some time now, and no one is threatening to unseat him. And it's all because of this unholy alliance between all these different people who want a greater Israel and see the strategy for a greater Israel being to put all the Arab countries and ultimately the Persian country that stands against them in disarray all around them, to shatter them, to leave them with no sovereignty, no real borders, as a matter of fact, so they can never muster armies to challenge the conventional might of Israel. I agree with you. I think it is a strategy fraught with potential for disaster, but they're pursuing it.
Yeah. Well, and then, I mean, if they're really pursuing greater, like capital G, greater Israel, then that means they're going to have to push all the Palestinians that live in the West Bank into the Jordan River or into Jordan, and maybe even further than that, into the deserts of western Iraq.
I think
they're
Jordan,
on the march. They're going to the Tigris.
I think Jordan is in their scope. I think parts of Syria beyond the Golan is in their scope. I think all of Israel proper, including Gaza and the West Bank, is in their scope. I think the Sinai is in their scope. But I do not see this divide and conquer, this dissemble the sovereignty of all these countries, as Henry Kissinger suggested the other day. I do not see that as a very effective strategy. What I see it as is doing is building a nest of vipers all around Israel.
Yeah,
and
well,
I'm
Michael
sorry,
Oren, I'm sure you saw where Michael Oren, the outgoing Israeli ambassador, said, to paraphrase, yeah, we prefer Al-Qaeda in Syria to Hezbollah. The obvious answer to that is, you're a madman. You know, Hezbollah does what Nasrallah says. Al-Qaeda, they don't do what anybody says. They do what they want. You know, they can't possibly prefer that.
Oren is not, his picture is not on my piano.
I mean, it's that's my whole frustration with, you know, what a hassle Israel is for American policy is the kind of double whammy is that it's a hassle for Israel, too. What they're doing is so self-defeating in every way. You mentioned the thing about the apartheid demographics, where even their own defense minister says that here before too long, they'll have you know, de facto full annexation. No longer will it be occupation. The West Bank and Gaza will just be part of Israel. And then at that point, they will be the apartheid minority, lording it over the majority. And then at that point, the entire game of Zionism is just, you know, ticking. The bomb is ready to go off. The whole thing's ready to fall apart at a moment's notice from that point. And then they keep doing it anyway.
And Israelis, maybe the greatest manifestation and proof of this, what you've just described, is Israelis are constantly now voting with their feet. And what I mean by that is Israelis who hearken back to the liberal founding, the 1948 founding, remember there were kibbutzes and there were communes and so forth. These Israelis are moving to Europe. Many of them have moved to Germany. Yes, of all places, back to Germany, living in Berlin and surrounding areas, and very happy, very contented. They have security, they have prosperity, they have a future to look forward to, as do their children and grandchildren, and they didn't have that in Israel, they felt, so they left. So you're getting Israelis who are voting with their feet and leaving the state of Israel because they sense what you've just described.
Yeah. Well, I know how they feel. I think I read about cops killing unarmed, innocent people all day, every day, and I think about moving from here. I don't like having right-wingers in power where I live either, but anyway. And yeah, the Democrats are right-wingers to me in that sense, as far as militarism and nationalism and the
isn't
local
it amazing?
Police state.
Presidents sure get power, and they never turn it loose.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, I'm not sure if I've ever asked you this, but back in, 10.5 years ago or so, during the whole UN speech and all that, did you guys know that the military, did anybody tell you, did you ask, did you wonder, did you know that the military had asked George Bush for permission to go to Kurdistan to hunt down and kill Zarqawi before the invasion numerous times, maybe even a dozen times, and had been told no just because they needed the talking point so they could pretend that Zarqawi, who Saddam wanted killed, was the link between Saddam and Osama bin Laden, who he had told, no, I don't want to join your movement, which was a primary subject of your boss's UN speech, of course.
I think there's probably a grain of what you just said that we knew at that time, but it was not nearly as clear as you're describing it now, and I'm not sure it's as clear as you're describing it now, because what the military was complaining about was a general tapestry of not being allowed, and when I say the military, it's mostly special forces, not being allowed to do things like go after bin Laden in Afghanistan, like go after other al-Qaeda leaders in other places at other times, or like go after what we were calling then the poison factory in the Kurdish portion of northern Iraq where Zarqawi was and his colleagues were set up. It was a general criticism that was registered by the military against the political leadership, and this included as far back as H.W. Bush, and then, of course, Clinton for 8 years, and then George W. Bush, because they would never approve the operations, being most often fearful that if we put boots on the ground, no matter how talented those boots might be, we might wind up with a set of those boots being paraded on a television by the host country, as it were, and shown as a prisoner of war or worse. So there never was the courage on the part of civilian leadership to say to the military, yeah, we see what you want to do in that particular episode, that particular incident, against that piece of intelligence, but we're not going to approve it. That was the general drift of things with regard to what people wanted to do against terrorists before 9/11.
Well, it's just that, you know, Kurdistan being friendly, autonomous, American, you know, friendly territory there, if Zarqawi was who he was claimed to be in the speech, then, man, he really needed killing before the invasion. Because, and then look what happened when he wasn't killed before the invasion up in friendly
Kurdistan. I don't disagree with that. I would disagree somewhat with your characterization of that portion where he was. That's pretty rough territory.
Okay, well, yeah, Turk. I mean, Saddam couldn't go there. America could go there easier than Saddam could go there, right, in Kurdistan before the war?
Some places, Sulaymaniyah, for example, but other places up in the mountains, you were taking your life in your hands going up there, whether you were Turk, whether you were Arab, or whether you were even Peshmerga and Kurdish. There were some tough areas up there, which is why Zarqawi was there.
Yeah. Well, makes sense. I guess the way the story was reported, it wasn't so much the general criticism, it was the... I think Jim Mikleshevsky reported, but it was reported a lot of other places too. I was surprised about all the different reports about this, where at least the military's version of it was that they had very specifically begged to go and get him, that they really did foresee how bad it was going to be if Baghdad fell and then this guy's on the loose out there, and we got to get him before the tanks roll in, kind of a thing. But that might have just been them patting themselves on the back, I guess.
Well, it's easy to extract these things from the general milieu and to say this is a specific example, and it looks like it without the other things attached to it. I will say this, too, though. Many times when we would sit down with counterterrorism people, military people, and civilian oversight policymakers, let's say, decision makers or advisors there, too, the military, particularly Delta, would throw up so many requirements that the civilians' eyes would roll back in the back of their heads. I mean, you'd be sitting there and a Delta operator would be saying, okay, we're going to do this. We need to know the lock that's on that door. We need to know the dimensions of the door. We need to know the depth of the roof, the material that composes the roof. You would get into all these intelligence requirements and people's eyes would be rolling around the table. Well, if you need these 300 items that will take us 6 weeks to gather, and we'll be lucky if we get 40% of them at 60% reliability, screw this. We're not going to authorize this. You've just convinced us that we shouldn't authorize it. So oftentimes the military was its own worst enemy.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because you're not the first person who's told stories just exactly along those lines, the specific lock and all of that. I've heard that before. Especially when they talk in terms of attempts or operations set up designed for going and getting bin Laden before September 11th, too.
And you also have to, many people don't understand until they don't have military experience, so they don't understand even when I try to explain this. One reason that SEAL Team 6, for example, or Delta today is so good is because they have been at war for 10 years. They have been doing 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, maybe even 100 operations on the ground a year or more. And you get really good when you do that. Well, they hadn't done much of anything back pre-9/11.
Right.
So the chances of them succeeding were far less than they would be, for example, today.
Right. All right, we got to go. Thank you very much for your time. It's good to talk to you again, Larry.
Surely. Take care.
All right, everybody. That's Lawrence Wilkerson. He's at William and Mary and at therealnews.com. We'll be right back with Mike Swanson after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
A nation's hope of lasting peace cannot be firmly based upon any race in armaments, but rather upon just relations and honest understanding with all other nations. This has been the way of life, forged by 8 years of fear and force. What can the world, or any nation in it, hope for if no turning is found on this dread road? The worst to be feared and the best to be expected can be simply stated. The worst is atomic war. The best would be this: a life of perpetual fear and tension, a burden of arms draining the wealth and labor of all peoples, a wasting of strength that defies the American system or the Soviet system or any system to achieve true abundance and happiness for the peoples of this earth. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Of course, that was Ike Eisenhower. What did he know about militarism? Probably nothing, best I can tell. Anyway, that is his chance for peace speech. And on topic, too, because our next guest is Mike Swanson, sponsor of this show, Wall Street Window. You hear the ads all the time. And also the ads for this great new book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. And this will be, I think, part 4 of our interview series, and probably the last one, on the subject of this great book, which I do hope you will get. It's a great history, a libertarian revisionist critical history of the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy years and the growth of the permanent executive branch, quite outside the White House. As you say in the book. Welcome back to the show, Mike. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, very happy to have you here, and very happy to read this book. It's really good. Congratulations on it. I really think it's something else.
Well, I appreciate it. I've been having all kinds of great feedback. People can see the reviews on Amazon, for example.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, you know, when I was much younger, the kind of very basic understanding that, you know, after World War II, World War II was a wonderful, wonderful war, but the consequence was the permanent arms industry, and they never went away. And it's, you know, when I was very young and I learned this, is still a very opaque subject. It's still only referring to a bunch of stuff I don't know about, kind of a thing, you know? But I think that this book could really do a lot to toward getting, you know, kind of mass consciousness understanding where people, I don't know, I think when Ike Eisenhower said that, I wasn't around for his farewell address and his Chance for Peace speech. But I think most people probably looked at him like, huh, you know, and weren't exactly sure what to make of it, weren't exactly sure what he was talking about. Of course, for a long time, to even talk about the military-industrial complex at all would be considered conspiracy theory stuff, even though Ike was the guy that coined the phrase. But anyway, I think that if a lot of people would read this thing and pass it around and leave them around and give them as gifts and really just, you know, somehow this should be the book. This ought to be the chance for the even that kind of basic conception of what went wrong with America, how it was that we got onto the wrong path that everybody seems to agree that we're on. It seems like this is a good chance. If it's not the chance, it's a really good chance, a good opportunity that people have to, well, you know, to help change the conversation, to change the society, to change common understanding of what it is that's the problem. And then that way when Mike Rogers opens his mouth and says, oh, well, we have to defend the NSA, whatever, whatever, everyone just hears military-industrial complex dollars and military power talking. We don't hear someone pretending to be our representative. We all know better than that, you know? That's the future I want to see. And I think that this book could help make it that way. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I hope, you know, more and more people in different ways are asking questions about, you know, the war on terror or our foreign policy and where it's led us. And my book is really trying to trace the roots of the situation today to back then. But, you know, I don't think it's just, you know, hardly political extremists or people that are only libertarians or people on the left. I think there's actually some people in government that are asking these questions too. I mean, even in the military, your last guest is certainly an example of someone who's had a distinguished career and has, you know, seen these things firsthand and learned from them just as Eisenhower did. And I mean, there's no one as intimate with war as Dwight Eisenhower was, you know, in World War II and as president. And in the speeches he gave, warning about the military-industrial complex, it's like he said, immediately after he left the presidency, it kind of just disappeared, that the phrase and the idea came out of nowhere, and it sort of vanished from national consciousness. And it wasn't really until the mid-60s with the rise of the Vietnam War that it really started to become a popular phrase and a way for people to understand what was happening to the country and what direction we're going. And that's really the goal of my book, is to try to it's sort of, writing the book was also my process of trying to figure out and understand the history of our country. And when it comes to the military-industrial complex, you know, it's pretty obvious, you know, that it has a huge cost to our society when it comes to spending money and taxes, just as that speech points out. But there's also another element to it that I think people really aren't aware of, and Eisenhower didn't exactly warn about it, and that is that an arms race itself can create war or create a temptation to go to war. And that's something I've seen very few people ever talk about or study. And in fact, the only book I can even think of that applies that concept to the United States is Gareth Porter's book about Vietnam, titled Perils of Dominance, which kind of explains, you know, the whole danger right there. And if we talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy, during the crisis, Kenny had a tense meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and basically told them that you know, he wants to prevent going to war, either by escalating into it, by the situation in the crisis getting out of control, or the phrase, the word he used was imbalance, meaning that the mere fact that the United States at the time had an overwhelming advanced nuclear strategic advantage over the Soviet Union could tempt the people to want to go to war.
Right. I mean, that's actually the thing. Well, I learned a lot of stuff reading this thing, but I guess one of the things I didn't really understand was, you know, the different nuclear policies before it settled to, you know, it came down eventually to more or less parity and mutually assured destruction. But back when the Americans were so much better armed nuclear weapons wise, than the Russians, Truman and Eisenhower both, and I forget about Kennedy, but certainly Truman and Eisenhower both used nukes as their, you know, to hear them tell it, as their poker chips or their, you know, playing cards in the game that they're screwing around with. And I think the way you write it was, it wasn't until after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when everybody's bluff had been completely called, that finally, that era of, you know, real brinksmanship, you know, came to an end. And it was just sort of the, I mean, even, I think you even say that after the detente of the 70s, and then you had the renewed kind of hawkishness of the early Reagan years, that still didn't compare to the pre-Cuban Missile Crisis way of doing things. I guess, you know, I'm not getting to what I mean very well, but you explain it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. The situation in the 60s, I would say, was extremely dangerous. You know, we almost went to war, a nuclear war, two times under the Kennedy administration. Eisenhower bluffed at it twice. I kind of doubt he was very serious about it, but the situations under Kennedy were very serious. The first one, of course, was a crisis over Berlin. The Russians and Khrushchev didn't have the Berlin Wall up, and people were leaving from the Eastern Bloc and into the West, going through Berlin, and he wanted to make some sort of deal and he made a war threat under Eisenhower over this, and Eisenhower just ignored him, which was a smart thing to do. But Kennedy and his advisors, they, you know, did a bit of a mobilization and made some very bellicose speeches, and that was a very, very tense summer, and it was in 1961, and even after the Cuban Missile Crisis, they looked back on that in interviews and said they were actually more scared of war those months than during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was really 2 days in the Cuban Missile Crisis that were the most dangerous, and that was the day before Kennedy got on TV and made his ultimatum or announced his blockade of Cuba. There was a space of hours that he knew he was going to make that speech and feared, you know, if the Russians found out, he's going to get on TV and do something that they might start a war before he does, in fear that we're just going to attack. And then the final day of the crisis, where the advisors were drifting in the direction of going to war and seemed to have given up almost on negotiating. I'd like to talk about that a little bit in detail. But as far as the 80s, you know, there were never any really direct threats or ultimatums given from one side or the other. Kennedy essentially sent messages to Khrushchev saying, if you don't take these missiles back, you know, we're going to go to war. I mean, that's essentially pointing a gun at the world and being willing to pull the trigger. Nothing like that happened in the 80s, despite, you know, talk of an evil empire and so forth. And, you know, of course, Reagan himself, just like Kennedy did, made a move to end the Cold War.
Right. Well, now, and then Eisenhower, I didn't realize that Eisenhower had basically threatened to use nukes against North Korea if they didn't come to the table and sign the damn thing right now. Well, half the country sign it or I'll nuke you, he said.
Yeah, he did that, you know, not directly, but under the table, passing a message to, I think it was the ambassador of India, that, you know, we would use any weapon necessary if you know, this war doesn't end or gets escalated even longer. And he was hoping they would pass that message on to China. It's not really clear, though, if that, you know, caused the end of the Korean War or even if they got the message. It's a dispute over that among historians, but he clearly, you know, made public threats to protect two islands off the coast of Taiwan. And another is that people, that's not in the book, and people don't really know, is that when South Vietnam, when Vietnam was divided in two, Diem came over to the United States, who was the leader we were backing in South Vietnam, and met with the Secretary of State and said that he was scared that the United States wouldn't fully support him. And they told him, well, don't worry, if they invade, if North Vietnam invades you, we'll just nuke them. So it was like a common way for these people to talk back then. But, you know, by the time after the Cuban Missile Crisis, neither side wanted to engage in such talk anymore. And the problem is, if you keep saying, you know, I'm going to use nuclear weapons or bluff at it, eventually you're either going to have to do it or you're going to lose the credibility of having these weapons.
Yeah. All right, now we got to take a break here in just a sec, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Cuban Missile Crisis and Curtis LeMay. Holy moly, the argument between Curtis LeMay and John Kennedy during that thing. And then we got to talk about the president getting shot in the head and some other things, too. So I don't mean the current one. Nobody come to my house. I'm talking about Kennedy back in 63. It's Mike Swanson, author of The War State. Hang tight. And yes, I'm a professional paranoid. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
Ah, it ain't so bad, really.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website where I keep all the interviews, more than 3,000 of them now. Going back to 2003, ScottHorton.org. Also, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right, so we're talking with our good friend Mike Swanson. He is the author of The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. Really good stuff. And now, I learned a little bit about the Cuban Missile Crisis when I was a kid because my dad was at UCLA at the time, and one of his professors, I guess his political science professor, somebody or other, whatever his name was, went off to Washington to be an advisor. I guess probably was not on the XCOM, but maybe was advising somebody who was or something like that. And when he came back, he told the students, there's no such thing as closer to nuclear war than that without just burning. That's it. That is the absolute brink within a hair's breadth. And that's the kind of danger that these maniacs on both sides put the entire world in, threatening speciesside. I mean, I guess humanity would have survived, you know, in the southern hemisphere somewhere in some form. But they, we're literally playing with completely annihilating civilization off the face of the planet. And then I'm reading your book and they're talking about, well, you know, we might lose all of our major cities and everything, but our country would survive enough that we could continue pursuing our national goals. What? These bureaucrats, they're just... That's the best kind of psychopath, is one of these goofballs with a typewriter, you know?
Oh, it's very it's crazy. It's amazing to try to put yourself in someone's frame of mind that can think like that. But I think one of the things that makes this Cuban Missile Crisis something really fascinating to read is that we have, you know, transcripts of almost every single one of the important meetings, and even meetings that were done in separate with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, there were notes taken for those. And one of the things that's kind of crazy is that the member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was the most, has been isn't really the right word, but the least excited to go to war, or the one asking questions at least, was the man who headed the Marine Corps. And, of course, you know, he would have had some responsibility if they invaded Cuba. And with the meeting with Kennedy, he makes a comment at one point that, you know, what's the point of invading Cuba? It's nothing but sand. I mean, like, there's nothing we're going to win. And just ignore the weapons. But he just kind of mumbles that, and he doesn't speak up anymore and comes to agree with the rest of them and does so in their own meetings together. But the most talkish person was, of course, General Curtis Lay, and he makes the statement in a meeting.
Now, he's head of the Strategic Air Command, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
The long-range bomber command.
Right, and the nuclear, over the man running the nuclear missile Minutemen program, too. And he tells the chief, you know, the other ones, look, we're spending $50 billion on SAC, they're getting 40% of the military budget. He says, what good is that unless we're going to use it? You know, I mean, how can you say something like that?
The original Madeleine Albright.
Yeah, yeah. And he's kind of, if you watch the movie, the Stanley Kubrick movie about nuclear war, what's it called?
Oh, Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, Dr. Strangelove. He's kind of like that. Colonel or General Turgenson is kind of patterned after him.
Mm-hmm.
But he, on the final day of the crisis, I didn't put this in the book, but he is so upset because they're not going to war and they're increasing the defenses in Cuba. And he tells the other chiefs he wants to personally go to the White House and challenge Kennedy, and I don't know what he was thinking he was going to tell them, and they talked him out of doing that. So, I mean, that's how, you know, bellicose he was. And when the crisis was over, he was in the White House and told Kennedy in the Oval Office that, you know, they have lost an opportunity and they've basically failed.
Yeah, that's the most, well, I don't know. I guess I was going to say the most, but no, they're two equally incredible stories of LeMay in here. One where he's demanding that the president invade or do airstrikes, start the war. And so Kennedy just does the slightest Socrates on him and just says, okay, but then what? And then what? Just a couple of times. And it ends up with him saying, yeah, they'll nuke our guys, but then we'll nuke them back real good. And then what? And then that means general nuclear war with the USSR, at least general on our side, and then the best they could do. But anyway, and that's, whatever. That's a price he's perfectly willing to pay because today's his big day. And then, which at least in the, I like to read that Kennedy's just shaking his head going, this guy, I can't believe, you know, thank God for that. But then, after the whole thing is brilliantly solved by, we'll quietly take our missiles out of Turkey and we'll smooth this whole thing over and no one will get hydrogen bombed to death, he goes back to the White House, LeMay does, to scream and yell and punch the table, pound his fist on the table and yell at the president for resolving the Cuban Missile Crisis without a war. It's amazing.
Well, not only does that happen, but I think it's the very next day, if not that day, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who Robert Kennedy names his son after, this man is the one of the two members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Kennedy really even gets along with, he sends a memo with all of their signatures on it, saying that they still recommend invading Cuba. And he attaches a note on top of the memo that he signed saying, well, this is what the rest of the chiefs think, but I disagree.
Right. That was Taylor, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So listen, everybody, it's Michael Swanson, and he's a sponsor of this show, WallStreetWindow.com. He's got investment advice for you there, and he's written this magnificent book, The War State. I really hope you'll read it. I can't wait to read the sequel about Vietnam that's coming up. But hang tight through this break. We'll be right back, and we got all kinds more things to talk about. I've been accused of gatekeeping you from discussing the assassination, so we can't let that go on. So, hang tight, everybody. It's Michael Swanson, author of The War State, on The Scott Horton Show.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live 3 to 5 here at Liberty Express Radio, No Agenda Radio, ScottHorton.org, Anomaly Radio, Liberty Movement Radio, Radio. Hey, if you just listened to the weekday show, then you missed Nima Shirazi was my guest over the weekend on KPFK. You can find that archive right there at the top of the page at ScottHorton.org, a great one as he debunks lies about Iran. War party lies debunked. Nima Shirazi there, ScottHorton.org. All right, we're talking with Mike Swanson, author of The War State, and I guess I sort of got a thing here. I should explain myself a little bit, Michael. The thing of it is that I always just figured that the CIA / military, whoever in the government, probably on behalf of some or other private factions outside of the government, bankers or arms manufacturers or somebody, they killed the president because they didn't like him anymore, and so that's what powerful people do to everybody, and including each other sometimes. So, you know, big deal. These things happen in corrupt world empires. But so I also, at the same time, even when I was much more of a conspiracy theorist, I never really got into the JFK thing because I figured I don't want to read that many different books about the same thing where I probably still am not going to be able to really know exactly what the case was, you know, who called which shots and who exactly pulled which triggers and from what angles and whatever. That's not really the point. The point is, sort of the meta point is, yeah, you know, it was the bad guys that shot him anyway, whatever. But so, you know, that's a long way of saying I don't really care about this issue that much. I never really liked Jack Kennedy all that much in the first place. And, you know, whatever. I don't really see that much of a difference, especially before I read your book. I saw much less of a difference between him and Johnson where it comes to the rubber meeting the road on the most horrible things about them. But you really do make the case that after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he really was getting his act together. He didn't turn, full Jacob Hornberger on us or anything, but he did want to start scaling these things back and cool off the tensions with the Soviets, etc. And so then that is obviously the big question, I guess, is do you think that the Curtis LeMays, not necessarily him, maybe him, but whoever, people like him, who didn't want to wait till the next election, went ahead and had the president shot in Dallas back in 63.
Well, the whole subject of the Kennedy assassination, it's something I read a lot of when I was like 20 years ago, about the time that JFK movie came out. And then, I probably read like 30 books of it. And back then, you could read 30 different theories of who did it or what group did it. Did the mob do it? The CIA did it? Did the Russians do it? And on and on. And then I just kind of, got away from reading about the thing. You can only read, like you said, you can only read so many books about something. But, writing this book, it does make you, well, first of all, from reading this stuff a long time ago, I'm pretty convinced that, there's some sort of conspiracy, I think, or at least one more person shooting. I think that's pretty evident to give you, all you have to do is read some of the testimony in the Warren Commission volumes and compare it to what is in the main book. For example, the doctor that operated on Governor Connally took out the bullet fragments from his body, and in the testimony he claims that, there's too many bullet fragments, and the magic bullet that supposedly hit both of them is too intact. It doesn't, so he basically says it doesn't make sense to him. But anyway, as far as who did it, I can't, really prove or say who did it without, having some real facts or something to back it up. There's plenty of people that, will just make claims to get attention or something. But where should I go from there?
Well, people want, I think people really see that more than the Second World War. They see the assassination of the president as the real crossing of the Rubicon here. Where, and, like even as Bill Hicks put it, where, wow, you're really just going to lie to us like that, and then we're just going to go on. And then that's it. And everybody's going to know that they're lying about it, and then, but we're going to let them lie about it. And now we're going to live in our society post that one time that they killed the president and lied about it, and we all just went along and pretended like it was all right. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. That's that's kind of a watershed for a society to let whoever it was did that get away with that,
Yeah, that's true. And when one of the things I guess that in a certain sense provoked me made me want to write this book a long time ago was if you take something an event like the Kennedy assassination or the Bay of Pigs or the Vietnam War, any one of these historical events, by themselves, they don't really tell you that much. They can give you a snapshot onto something. So people will study this Kennedy assassination thinking it's like the secret thing. If they unlock it, they can figure something big out. But in the end, I think what is the important thing about the time period since World War II is, in fact, the changes that occurred in the country from after the war till basically the time Eisenhower gives that speech, which is we transform into what is a permanent state of war in the United States. We're on a war footing all the time, and we have to have a military-industrial complex to back it up and a national security state that has to operate in secrecy. I mean, that's what your last guest was speaking about, too. And I think the Kennedy assassination, regardless of who did it, and it's probably impossible to know for sure, that's just the story of that. And the cover-up for the assassination is actually pretty well documented. And it's something people kind of don't write about or ignore because everyone wants to focus on who killed them. But You know, there's presidential tapes of Lyndon Johnson the moment he gets in the White House speaking about the details of the assassination with Hoover and what Hoover has found. And you know, Hoover says that in the very first conversation that's recorded that he has evidence that Oswald was being impersonated by somebody in Mexico City. He took a trip to Mexico City in October of 1963 and went to the Cuban and Soviet embassies, and the CIA recorded him calling these embassies. They supposedly took pictures of him, and Hoover tells them that this information doesn't match at all with Oswald. So that alone is an indication of something, and Lyndon Johnson basically tells Orrin Warren in a meeting, who heads the Warren Commission, that, you know, there's too many rumors going around that Oswald met with a Soviet KGB agent, and we don't want to have a world war. So I think in the end, actually, whatever we think today, that a lot of the people that were covering this up were motivated for what they thought were good reasons.
Well, that's the scene out of JFK 2 where he turns Costner's guy against him. He says, the FBI guy grabs him and pulls him in the alley and says, "It was Castro, you dummy, and you're going to start a world war. So stop getting to the bottom of this," and convinces the guy to turn rat on him and all that, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what the argument was given to Earl Warren in a meeting. And it's also, you can listen to it on a presidential tape. You can go to YouTube. If you type in LBJ, Richard Russell, Warren Commission, there's several tapes on there where there you can hear him very clearly talking about this. And mm-hmm. and Richard Russell tells him who was the senator. He tells Johnson, "I don't want to get on this Warren Commission. I hate Earl Warren. He's from the South, and he doesn't support the civil rights movement." And Johnson basically tells him, "I need you on there. If you don't get on there, you know, you don't know what could happen. The FBI, you know, is out here, and the IRS, and I can't tell you I'm going to use them or anything like that, but the country needs you." And there's a lot more, the words he uses is, there's a lot more on the surface, and we don't want a war, you know. But if you go to the Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City, I mean, that's that would seem to suggest the Soviets weren't involved in it, and someone somewhere in the government had some sort of hand in it. Who knows who they were working for, but yeah. I think that's the basic story that in.
And that's kind of where we started there is, yeah, we're still stuck with best guesses and speculations and whatever. You know, I know some old Texans, and I guess I've kind of heard my whole life that everybody in Texas knew LBJ did it as soon as it happened. Not that they were too upset about it, really. But old Lyndon shooting the president in the face, you know how he is. And it was just a matter of fact. Everybody knew that. There was no secret to it, kind of a thing, you know? At least in some places, anyway. And I don't know, obviously that doesn't amount as proof. I was going to say one more thing about Johnson's guilty conscience was something I saw probably on the Discovery Channel, one of those things within the last couple of years, talked about how Johnson was terribly concerned that Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general, would somehow try to invoke some law to keep him from becoming the president and inheriting the Oval Office there, which seemed to me to be, man, only because you're afraid that he's going to call you on the fact that you did it, because otherwise, if you're just a vice president of a assassinated president surprised as everybody else, then where would you even come up with that? No matter what kind of enmity there is with the Kennedy brothers or whatever at that point, Bobby Kennedy couldn't stop. Wouldn't even think to try unless he thought that LBJ was the trigger man. You know what I mean? So why would LBJ think that he would?
Stop him from. I don't. It's hard to tell. I'd have to see what that conversation was, but I'm pretty skeptical that he was behind it or something. And the reason why is that, or one of the reasons why is that I think LBJ himself, you know, was kind of a cowardly person. To give you two examples, when Kennedy was president, he asked him to go to Germany and drive up the Autobahn after this Berlin crisis was settled, and he asked him to go to Vietnam to take a trip. And both times, Johnson told him, "I'm afraid that I'd be killed, you know, if like a world start or something." And he also had a habit of liking to manipulate people and make them feel sorry for him, or else either tried to intimidate him, one or the other. And I would guess that conversation would be him trying to play that sort of game.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. There are a lot of people know a hell of a lot more about LBJ than I do, that's for sure. But anyway, I mean, that's sort of my point anyway, is that, you know, you can. It could have been Oswald, it could have been the CIA or the military or the oil guys or the Lockheed guys or the whoever guys, but, I mean, anyway, to me it doesn't make all that much difference. So let's just pretend Nixon won in 60. What difference does it make, you know?
Well, all that said, I think one thing that's, you know, historical understanding and interpretation and knowledge changes over time and hopefully improves over time. And when the that JFK movie came out, the Congress authorized the release of secret documents related to the assassination. Not all of them have been released. There's a whole batch of them supposed to be released by the CIA in 2017. But one thing that has happened is the release of new information by the government since that movie came out has enabled anyone who's researching this time period to have a better understanding, not simply of details of the assassination, and there's, you know, plenty of people reading that stuff and writing about it and planning to write more books about it and so forth, and hopefully they'll come up with more information. But it also is leading to a greater understanding of, you know, what was actually going on during his presidency and also Lyndon Johnson's presidency and the whole era, and that's stuff that I'm trying to work on putting these books for now, basically.
Mm-hmm. All right, now we got to talk about money. You cite Foreign Affairs here saying that, listen, the empire's broke, and so the American people are going to have to cut back, not the empire. And I wonder if you could explain from your view just how broke is America and just how much of that is because of the militarism and just how different might it be if we abandoned the empire and made our government mind nobody's business and just had a normal country in a normal time.
Well, we're spending close to 40% of the entire federal budget on either military spending or debts piled up due to it. And this could be from wars or just buying these weapon systems and whatever. And, I mean, I think it's hard to argue against the idea of cutting the military budget, even if you want to accept the premise of, you know, the need to defend the country from terrorism. I don't see any usage of, you know, these F-22 fighters and all these aircraft carriers to fight terrorists. But so I think the war on terror could be fought smartly, and, you know, in the end, it's probably better to pull a lot more stuff back and get rid of this empire regardless, but you could do a better way, a cheaper way. But more important, though, is the drain on the national wealth. You know, so much of our tax dollars are going to this. We're just draining everything away. And even people, if you want to think, well, you know, it's providing jobs and whatnot, there's statistics that show that it costs about $100,000 worth of government spending to create one job in the defense industry. So that doesn't seem like a cost-effective way to to use stimulus spending. But as far as how close we are to being broke, that's a fascinating, crazy, interesting question, because the CBOE projections that Congress have that uses, and most mainstream economists in articles like that one will say that we're on a path to go broke, the whole country to go broke, or the federal government, by 2030, unless government spending is drastically cut and taxes are raised and social spending is put under control. So that Foreign Affairs article says basically that's what we need to do, and everyone's living standards would just have to fall in order to maintain defense spending. However, there's an article I read in February written by a man named Fred Mishkin, who used to be on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. And in 2007, he wrote an article predicting real estate declining and everything essentially that happened afterwards, interest rates going to zero, the economy slowing down. Well, in February, he wrote an article, and these are articles for the Federal Reserve, not in newspapers and stuff. It's titled Crunch Time, so anyone can do a Google search and see this for themselves. Just type Fred Mishkin Crunch Time. And in it, he says the CBOE projections are totally incorrect because they're based on the assumption that interest rates will stay at their current really low levels basically forever. And he claims if they go up, the 10-year treasury bond yields 5.25% or higher, that, and it's at 2-something now, that the cost of financing the debt will skyrocket and the United States will go through some sort of currency crisis and serious problems. So, and he claims this could happen by 2018. So that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's a lot of money when you start counting up all of the different kinds of debt, not just the national debt, but and you know, I don't know, it's all over time. So, but then again, every time they say that they're going to scale back on the expansion of the money supply, they end up not scaling back on it, right?
Well, yeah. Well, his argument is that they will have to increase it to keep in. What happens is bonds, if interest rates go up, bonds fall in value, and he claims the Fed will just have to print an enormous amount of money to keep that from happening, which would cause lots of inflation in the economy. My second, you know, to tie that into the book is, you know, after I read it, I looked back on my own life, and, you know, I'm really a product of, I'm 38 years old, and my father, he was in the military, born around the end of World War II, right before it. And that's, I'm a product of this war system, you know. We all are. I was a kid watching Star Trek, was my favorite show, and that show is all tied into this. You know, the whole idea of it's kind of an idealized version of the military and the American Empire and liberal ideals and so forth. Well, the whole system is based on this Federal Reserve debt system and the dollar being the reserve currency of the world, and it wasn't that before World War II. We weren't the reserve currency. And if that all comes to an end one day, and I think it probably will in our lifetime, then this whole system that's in this book will, I think, will be changed, or something. We'll be living in a drastically different type of world, or country at least.
Yeah, you know, Chalmers Johnson used to always say that you either have to give up your empire or you're going to live under it. And of course, I think he also predicted just as well as anybody could have that if you ask D.C., the empire is what they'll give up last. They'll get rid of Social Security. They won't just privatize it, so-called privatize it or whatever. They'll abolish it before they abolish the empire if we let them choose. You know, they'll get rid of every last bit of food stamps or anything like that in order to, you know, balance the budget on the back of the poor so they can continue killing poor people in other countries, too.
That may be true. The Foreign Affairs article certainly seems to suggest that. And right after that article, there's one advocating for more defense spending. So there you go.
Yeah, but unusable nuclear weapons. Yeah, it's too bad that we've got these nukes are too big to use. We need a new generation of tactical nukes that we can deploy all over the place at a moment's notice. That's how to rule the world on the cheap there. Call it the new look for the new century.
Crazy. Would people really put up with that? I think at some point, that's the most amazing thing to me, that since 2008, is there haven't been, any real movements to do anything, except this Tea Party, which I don't know if that's even a real movement. I mean, there's no real movement of any sort, like there was in the 60s or the 30s or dozens of other times in American history. But, well, if things really get worse again or something and people are forced to make a choice, then I think they will start making choices that are different.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, there's just nothing more wasteful than American militarism. And just think of what it costs to fill up an Abrams tank and drive it for a little while. I mean, you know what I mean? Just the Pentagon, just in terms of oil consumption, they're, the eighth biggest nation in the world or something, just the Pentagon. Maybe it's the fourth, something like that. It's ridiculous. It seems to me no matter what your issue is, at the end of the day, especially for environmentalism for one, at the end of the day, the military is the worst offender at whatever you're angry about, including breaking up families and all of those kinds of conservative issues and obviously spending issues. And it's the root of everything that's wrong. And anyway, I wish people get it through their head. Although, here's a little bit of irony for the end of the show here. It seems like it was the military that said no to the war on Syria as much as the American people said no. I don't know if they were refusing, but they made it known that they did not want to get bogged down in that thing. What do you think that represents when they're telling the human rights activists in the State Department to cool it?
Yeah, the same thing evidently happened in Iran when Bush was president.
Yeah.
One of the regional commanders said, he would protest if they wanted him to start a war there.
That's pretty strange, old standing army,
Yeah. Well, I mean, right now, really, I do think it is kind of ironic that people in general aren't doing anything, and it is people in the government that are the ones, speaking out and resisting or whatever. They don't necessarily all have to be leaking out information, but that's what's going on.
Well, I get emails from people all the time who say, they're former military, former military contractors even, who say, I'd be listening to your show working at Raytheon all day, and I decided that one of these things had to give, so I left and got a real job. That's pretty nice, because I think, you got a front row seat to the way it works and shouldn't be working, then, you got a choice to make. Anyway, so we're out of time. Thanks very much for your time. It's great to talk to you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, everybody, that's the great Michael Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com, and writermichaelswanson.com. The book is The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. Just look in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.